Thank you more than I can say. Madam President, it's becoming habitual. Members of the governing boards and ladies and gentlemen. When I was younger, I used to hear Harvard stories from a member of the class of 1885. Back then, old graduates of the college who could get to Cambridge on commencement day didn't wait for reunion years to come back. They just turn up, see their old friends, look at the new crop, and drink some commencement punch under the elms. And the old man remembered one of those summer days when he was heading for the square after lunch, and he crossed paths with one of the newly graduated seniors who had had quite a few cups of commencement punch after lunch. And as the two men approached each other, the younger one thrust out his new diploma and he said, "Educated, by God." Well, even with an honorary Harvard doctorate in my hands now, I know enough not to shout that across the yard. But the university's generosity does make me bold enough to say that over the course of 19 years on the Supreme Court, I learned something about the Constitution of the United States and something about what judges do when they apply it in deciding constitutional cases. And I'm going to draw on that experience over the next few minutes because it is, of course, as a judge that I have been asked and given the honor to speak before you. The occasion for our coming together this afternoon aligns with the approach of two separate events in the judicial side of our national life. One is the end of the approaching end of the Supreme Court's term with the quickening pace of decisions that come down then. And the other is the approaching confirmation proceedings for a new member of the Supreme Court. And as a consequence of both of those impending events, we will be hearing and we will probably be discussing a good deal a certain sort of criticism that is frequently aimed at the more controversial Supreme Court decisions. We've all heard it, criticism that the court is making up law, that the court is announcing constitutional rules that cannot be found in the Constitution itself, and that the court is engaging in activism to extend civil liberties. A good many of us, I'm sure a good many of us here, intuitively react that this sort of commentary tends to miss the mark, but we don't often pause to consider in any detail the conceptions of the Constitution and of constitutional judging that underlie that critical rhetoric, any more than we can stop to compare them with the notions that underlie our own intuitive reactions. And this afternoon, by way of a couple of stories and some lessons to be drawn from them, I'm going to try to make those comparisons with you. The charges of lawmaking, constitutional novelty, seem to be based on an impression of the Constitution and on a sort of template for deciding constitutional claims that go together something like this. A claim is made in court that the government is entitled to exercise a power or an individual is entitled to the benefit of some right. In each case, set out in the terms of a particular provision of the Constitution. The claimant quotes the provision and provides evidence of facts that is said to prove the entitlement that is claimed. Once those facts have been determined, they, on their face, either do or do not support the claim. If they do, the court gives judgment for the party who asked for it, and if they don't, judgment goes to the party who contested the claim. On this view, deciding constitutional cases should be a straightforward exercise of reading fairly and viewing facts objectively. And there are, of course, some constitutional cases that would be decided just about the way this, I'll call it, the fair reading model would have it. If one of this morning's 21-year-old college graduates, for example, claimed a place on the ballot for one of the open seats in the United States Senate this fall, the claim could be disposed of simply by showing the person's age, quoting the constitutional provision that a senator must be at least 30 years old, and interpreting that requirement to forbid access to the ballot to someone who could not qualify to serve if elected. No one would be apt to claim that lawmaking was going on, and no one would be likely to object that the age requirement did not say anything about ballot access. The fair reading model would describe pretty much what would happen, but cases like this do not usually come to court, certainly not to the Supreme Court of the United States. And the ones that do get there, for the cases that tend to raise the national blood pressure, the fair reading model has only a very tenuous connection to reality. We don't have to think long to show why it is so unrealistic. The Constitution is filled with deliberately open-ended guarantees like due process and equal protection and freedom from unreasonable searches. And these provisions cannot be applied like the requirement for 30-year-old senators. They require more elaborate reasoning to show why very general language applies in some specific cases but not in others. And over time, the various examples turn into rules that the Constitution does not itself specifically mention. But this explanation hardly scratches the surface. The reasons that constitutional judging is not a mere combination of fair reading and simple facts extend way beyond the recognition that constitutions have a lot of general language in them in order to be useful as constitutions. Another reason is that the Constitution contains values that may very well exist in tension with each other, not in harmony. And yet another reason is that the facts that determine whether a constitutional provision applies or not may be very different from facts like a person's age or the amount of the grocery bill. Constitutional facts may require judges to understand the meaning that facts bear before the judges can figure out what to do about them. And this can be tricky. To show you what I'm getting at, I've picked two examples of what can really happen. Two stories of two great cases. The two stories will not, of course, give anything like a complete description either of the Constitution or of judging, but I think they will show how unrealistic the fair reading model can be. The first story is about what the Constitution is like. It's going to show that the Constitution is no simple contract, not because it uses a certain amount of open-ended language that a constitutional draftsman would hope to avoid, but because its language grants and guarantees many good things, and good things that compete with each other, and can never all be realized all together, all the time. The story is about a case that many of us here remember. It was argued before the Supreme Court of the United States on June 26, 1971, and we all know it as the Pentagon Papers. The New York Times and the Washington Post had each obtained copies of classified documents that had been prepared and compiled by government officials responsible for conducting the Vietnam War. The newspapers intended to publish some of those documents, and the government sought a court order forbidding the publication. The issue had arisen in great haste, and it traveled from the trial courts to the Supreme Court, not over the course of months, but in the course of days. The time was one of high passion, and the claim made by the United States was the most extreme claim known to the constitutional doctrines of freedom to speak and to publish. The government said it was entitled to a prior restraint. An order forbidding publication in the first place, not merely one imposing a penalty for unlawful publication after the words are out. And the argument in that great case included an exchange between a great lawyer appearing for the government and a great judge. And the colloquy between them was one of those instances of a grain of sand that contains the universe. The great lawyer for the United States was a man who spent many commencement mornings in this yard, for he was Irwin Griswold, dean of the law school for 21 years, who was then serving a stint as Solicitor General of the United States. The great judge was Mr. Justice Black, the first of the New Deal justices, whom Justice Cardozo described as having one of the most brilliant legal minds he had ever met with. The constitutional provision on which their exchange centered was the First Amendment, which includes the familiar words that Congress shall make no law abridging the freedom of speech or of the press. Although that language, by its literal terms, forbade Congress from legislating to abridge free expression, the guarantees were understood to bind the whole government and to limit what the president could ask a court to do. As for the remainder of the provision, though, Justice Black professed to read it literally. When it said there shall be no law allowed, it left no room for any exception. The prohibition against abridging freedom of speech and press was absolute. And in fairness to him, one must say that on their face, the First Amendment clauses seem as clear as the requirement for 30-year-old senators. And one has to say that no guarantee of the Bill of Rights is more absolute in form. But that was not the end of the matter for Dean Griswold. Notwithstanding the language, he urged the court to say that a restraint would be constitutional when publication threatened irreparable harm to the security of the United States. And he contended there was enough in the record to show just that. He argued that the intended publications would threaten lives and jeopardize the process of trying to end the war and recover prisoners, and would erode the government's capacity to negotiate with foreign governments and through foreign governments in the future. Justice Black responded that if a court could suppress publication when the risk to the national interest was great enough, the judges would be turned into censors. Dean Griswold said he did not know of any alternative. Justice Black shot back that respecting the First Amendment might be the alternative, and to that, Dean Griswold replied in words that I cannot resist quoting. The problem in this case, he said, is the construction of the First Amendment. Now, Mr. Justice, your construction of that is well known, and I certainly respect it. You say that no law means no law, and that should be obvious. I can only say, Mr. Justice, that to me it is equally obvious that no law does not mean no law. And I would seek to persuade the court that that is true. As Chief Justice Marshall said so long ago, it is a constitution we are interpreting. The government lost the case and the newspapers published, but Dean Griswold won his argument with Justice Black. To show, as he put it, that no law did not mean no law, Dean Griswold pointed out that the First Amendment was not the whole constitution. The Constitution also granted authority to the government to provide for the security of the nation and authority to the president to manage foreign policy and command the military. And although he failed to convince the court that the capacity to exercise those powers would be seriously affected by publication of the papers, the court did recognize that at some point the authority to govern that Dean Griswold invoked could limit the right to publish. The court did not decide the case on the ground that the words no law allowed of no exception and meant that the rights of expression were absolute. The court's majority decided only that the government had not met a high burden of showing facts that could justify a prior restraint, In particular, members of the court spoke of examples that might have turned the case around to go the other way. Threatened publication of something like the D-Day invasion plans could have been enjoined. Justice Brennan mentioned a publication that would risk a nuclear holocaust in peacetime. Even the First Amendment, then, expressing the value of speech and publication in terms of a right as paramount as any fundamental right can be, even the First Amendment does not quite get to the point of an absolute guarantee. And it fails because the Constitution has to be read as a whole, and when it is, other values crop up in potential conflict with unfettered rights to publish. The value of security for the nation and the value of the president's authority in matters foreign and military. The explicit terms of the Constitution, in other words, can create a conflict of approved values, and the explicit terms of the Constitution do not resolve that conflict when it arises. The guarantee of the right to publish is unconditional in its terms, and in its terms, the power of the government to govern is plenary. As a consequence, a choice may have to be made, not because language is vague, but because the Constitution embodies the desire of the American people, like most people, to have things both ways. We want order and security, and we also want liberty. And we want not only liberty, but equality as well. And these pairs of desires of ours can clash, and when they do, a court is forced to choose between them, between one constitutional good thing and another one. The court has to decide which of our approved desires has the better claim, right here, right now. And a court has to do a lot more than read fairly when it makes this kind of choice. And choices like ones that the justices envisioned in the papers case make up of what much of what we mean by law. Let me ask a rhetorical question. Should the choice and its explanation in these cases be called illegitimate lawmaking? Can it be an act beyond the judicial power when a choice must be made and the Constitution has not made it in advance in so many words? Well, you know my answer. So much for the notion that all of constitutional law lies there in the Constitution and waiting for a judge to read it fairly. Now let me tell a second story. Not one illustrating the tensions within the Constitution or within constitutional law, but one showing the subtlety of constitutional facts. Again, the story is about a famous case, and still a good many of us here remember this one too, because it was Brown v. Board of Education in 1954, the case in which the Supreme Court unanimously held that racial segregation in public schools imposed by law was unconstitutional, as violating the guarantee of equal protection of the law. Brown ended the era of separate but equal, whose paradigm was the decision in 1896 of the case called Plessy and Ferguson. And in that case, the Supreme Court had held it was no violation of equal protection to require black people to ride in a separate railroad car that was physically equal to the car for whites. One argument that had been offered in Plessy was that the separate black car was a badge of inferiority. And to that, the court majority responded at the time that if black people viewed it that way, the implication was merely a product of their own minds. 60 years later, Brown held that a segregated school required for black children was inherently unequal. For those whose exclusive norm of constitutional judging is merely fair reading of language applied to facts subjectively viewed, Brown must be either flat-out wrong or a very mystifying decision. Those who tend to look to that model are unlikely to think that a federal court back in 1896 should have declared legally mandated racial segregation unconstitutional. But if Plessy was not wrong, how is it that Brown came out so differently? The language of the Constitution's guarantee of equal protection of the laws did not change between 1896 and 1954. And it would be very hard to say that the obvious facts on which Plessy was based had changed. While Plessy was about railroad cars and Brown was about schools and schoolrooms, that distinction was no great difference. And actually, the best clue to the difference between the cases is the dates they were decided, which I think lead to the explanation for their divergent results. As I have said elsewhere, the members of the court in the Plessy case remembered the day when human slavery was the law in much of the land. To that generation, the formal equality of an identical railroad car meant enormous progress. But the generation in power in 1954 looked at enforced separation without the revolting background of slavery to make it look unexceptional by contrast. As a consequence, the judges in 1954 found a meaning in segregation that the majority of their predecessors in 1896 simply did not see. That meaning is not captured by descriptions of physically identical schools or physically identical railroad cars. The meaning of facts arises elsewhere, and its judicial perception turns on the experience of the judges and on their ability to think from a point of view that is different from their own. Meaning comes from the capacity to see what is not, in some simple objective sense, there on a printed page. And when the judges of 1954 read the record of enforced segregation, it carried only one possible meaning to them. It expressed a judgment of inherent inferiority on the part of the minority race. And the judges who understood the meaning that was apparent in 1954 would have violated their oaths to uphold the Constitution if they had not held the segregation mandate unconstitutional. Again, a rhetorical question. Did the judges of 1954 cross some limit of legitimacy into lawmaking by stating a conclusion that you will not find written in the Constitution? Was it activism to act based on the current meaning of facts that at a purely objective level were about the same as Plessy's facts 60 years before? Again, of course, you know my answer. And so much for the assumption that facts just lie there waiting for an objective judge to view them. So let me, like the lawyer I am, sum up the case I've tried to present this afternoon. The fair reading model fails to account for what the Constitution actually says, and it fails just as badly to understand what judges have no choice but to do. The Constitution is a pantheon of values, and a lot of hard cases are hard because the Constitution gives no simple rule of decision for the cases in which one of the values is truly at odds with another. Not even its most uncompromising and unconditional language can resolve every potential tension of one provision with another provision, a tension that the Constitution's framers left to be resolved another day. And another day after that, for our cases can give no answers that fit all conflicts and no resolutions that are immune to rethinking when the significance of old facts have changed with the changing world. And these are reasons enough to show how egregiously it misses the point to think of judges in constitutional cases as just sitting there reading constitutional phrases fairly and looking at reported facts objectively to produce their judgments. Judges have to choose between the good things that the Constitution approves, and when they do, they have to choose not on the basis of measurements, but of meanings. The fair reading model misses that, but it misses even more. Remember that the tensions that are the stuff of judging in so many hard constitutional cases are, after all, creatures of our aspirations. Aspirations to liberty as well as to order, and to fairness and equality as well as to liberty. And the very opportunity for conflict between one high value and another reflects our confidence that a way may be found to resolve it when a conflict arises. That is why the simplistic view of the Constitution devalues our aspirations, and it attacks our confidence, and it diminishes us. It is a view of judging that means to discourage our tenacity, including our sometimes reluctant tenacity, to keep the constitutional promises the nation has been made. So it is tempting. It is tempting to dismiss the critical record of rhetoric of lawmaking and activism as simply a rejection of too many of the hopes we profess to share as the American people. But there is one thing more. I have to believe that something deeper is involved, and that behind most of the dreams of a simpler constitution, there lies a basic human hunger for the certainty and control that the fair reading model seems to promise. And who has not felt that same hunger? Is there any one of us who has not lived through moments and perhaps years of longing for a world without any ambiguity? For the stability of something unchangeable in human institutions? I don't forget my own longing, a longing for certainty that resisted the pronouncement of Justice Holmes, which I read as an undergraduate, that certainty generally is illusion and repose is not our destiny. But I have come to understand that he was right. And by the same token, I understand that I differ from the critics I've described, not merely in seeing the patent wisdom of Brown or in espousing the rule excluding unlawfully seized evidence or in understanding the scope of habeas corpus. Where I suspect we differ most fundamentally is in my belief that in an indeterminate world I cannot control, it is still possible to live fully in the trust that a way will be found leading through the future, uncertain as it is. And to me, the future of the Constitution as the framers wrote it can be staked only upon that same trust. If we cannot share every intellectual assumption that formed the minds of those who framed the Charter, we can still address the constitutional uncertainties the way they must have envisioned, by relying on reason, by respecting all the words the framers wrote, by facing facts, and by seeking to understand the meaning of those facts for living people. That is how a judge lives in a state of trust, and I know of no other way to make good on the aspirations that tell us who we are and who we mean to be as the people of the United States.